Okay, yeah, so we're really happy to welcome back our friend Ken. He's very kindly agreed to give this presentation today, which is it's on souvenir embroidery in Kathmandu. So.
Kind of presenting quite different paper from the last ones I gave here. I'm going to talk about what I call the souvenir embroidery in Kathmandu, which some of you might have seen. So over the past years, I've been so passionate about this phenomenon of souvenir embroidery in Kathmandu, and have conducted some fieldwork by collecting some early samples and interviewing some local embroiderers. Today I discuss souvenir embroidery from different perspectives, but especially its aspect of cultural appropriation on the basis of the evidence of the material culture. So, as all of us know, Kathmandu is the capital city of Nepal, sandwiched between China and India, and it has a rich cultural tradition and both of Buddhism and Hinduism, as far as religions are concerned, and it's got a lot of UNESCO World Heritage and stuff, and so that's why it's attracted many tourists over the past decades, and then some of them started commissioning the so-called souvenir embroidery from the mid-1990s onwards, when the tourism industry there was at its peak. But first of all, I'd like to familiarize you with the souvenir embroidery in terms of technology, iconography, sociocultural context, and history. I then discuss the social role and the cultural meaning of iconographies in among different groups of foreign travelers. Especially hippie-type foreign travelers, with some case studies of particular iconographies. It's very hard to define souvenir embroidery in Kathmandu. In short, I would broadly define that the souvenir embroidery is the particular kind of embroidery were commissioned by or made for foreign travelers, especially of hippie types, as a reminders or mementos of their trip to Nepal. And it is characterized by such iconographies as trekking maps, Om, Buddha eyes, Yin Yang, Dharma Chakra, Tibetan Endless Knot, mandalas, Kathmandu dragons, yaks, the Yeti, Celtic knots, Hard Rock Cafe Kathmandu, which doesn't exist, and or cannabis leaves or magic mushrooms. I would like to explore this material culture through the theory of cultural appropriation. It generally means adaptation of some specific elements of one culture by a different cultural group, or one culture taking parts from another culture. For instance, in the forms of food, lifestyle, religions, music, or material culture, or like use. the term often has a negative connotation, especially in the context of indigenous or minority cultures, and it also involves a forced cultural adaptation to the dominant culture, often under colonization. Nevertheless, I'm focusing rather on the kind of positive side of this cultural appropriation, as well as the degree to which this process can operate. While Western women wearing bindis are often not regarded as cultural appropriation, some of the Italian dreadlocks adapting Rastafarianism introduced as a cultural appropriation. At the same time, the cultural adaptation of one or another element of a different culture, when reintroduced through your own culture, does not qualify itself as a cultural appropriation. Therefore, I would like to argue that the case of Sylvanian embroidery demonstrates a cultural appropriation of indigenous religious practices and materialities, you know, due to the direct, spontaneous, and reciprocal interactions of hippie-type foreign travelers. So, technology. So, what makes Sylvanian embroidery so special is the application of the technology of the freehand side-swing sewing machine designed specifically for embroidery work. So, this specialized sewing machine was customized in Japan as early as the early Taisho period in the first quarter of the 20th century for embroidering kimono, our Japanese our traditional costume. Simply speaking, side-swing sewing machine embroidery means that the needle swings sideways to embroider the fabric. However, it involves a highly complex operation. The speed of sewing machine is controlled by a foot pedal, while the width of the side swing of the needle is adjusted by pushing a lever positioned around the right knee. Simultaneously, the fabric has to be moved by hand as the embroidery goes on. So it requires highly experienced craftsmanship. And in Japan, the number of side swing embroidery craftsmen has significantly gone down. But this tradition is preserved in Kathmandu Valley in the form of a Sylvanian embroidery. So it is still a form of a leading craftsmanship and a flourishing business in Kathmandu, but reached its zenith in late 1990s and the early 2000s, prior to the Maoist insurgency. With well over 200 shops in Kathmandu alone, scattered around Tamil, at the tourist hotspots of Tamil and the Freak Street. So during this period, the iconography was very much standardized and shared by almost all the shops, resembling one another with a slight difference. So here's a photograph of a typical Sylvanian embroidery shop in Kathmandu. As in many other shops in Tamil, the Sylvanian embroidery shops or ateliers are normally very small in size. Most of the shops have one or more side swing sewing machines in a shop, and they perform demonstrations. There's also one or another display cases showing some patches for sale, and the walls are often covered with ready-made embroidered t-shirts, as well as sample designs. More importantly, one finds an Islamic altar on some upper part of the walls, as most of embroidery shops in Kathmandu are run by native or migrant Muslims. So this kind of Sylvanian embroidery for the foreign market originates from a post-World War to Japan. In the late 1940s, Japan started producing a so-called Sylvanian jacket, heavily embroidered with Japanese traditional designs, such as tigers, eagles, and dragons, onto Western-style shirts or jackets by side-swing embroidery machine for American soldiers as their souvenirs. So in the beginning, they were sold in some souvenir shops in Ginza, in Tokyo, or some others near American bases in Japan. But in 1947, the souvenir jackets were made into proper products and started to be sold within American bases in Japan as official souvenirs. The tradition also continues as seen on these later examples. The one on the top left from my own collection is so-called a Vietnam jacket, commissioned by American soldiers and produced by migrant Indian craftsmen living in Vietnam in the late 1960s. The boring shirts on the right from my collection, I bought it long time ago, is a so-called military bowling shirt. So this design was produced for 6,100 Cameron stationed in Tachikawa Air Base around that time. So, and then this kind of tradition also continues into 1980s and 90s, and as you can see from much later examples at the bottom. So apart from technologies, such as Subani embroidery in Japan is much parallel to that in Kathmandu in terms of a selection of iconography to suit the taste of the foreigners. For example, the map theme was prevalent both in Japan and Nepal. For example, the dragon as well, which was the main iconography of the both Japanese and Kathmandu Subani embroidery. They kind of still remain predominantly popular in Kathmandu. So then the main body of my research materials comes from the design samples originally hung from the walls in shops. I acquired numerous such examples, some on display and the others in storage. In some cases, it took me a very long time to negotiate with the owners, as many as 3 years. And, I then began to identify some of the early sample designs of superb quality of highly skilled embroiderers by the highly skilled embroiderers, mostly dating from the mid-90s to the early 2000s. So the samples come in squares or rectangular shapes. For large designs, one sample contains one design, but different smaller designs are embroidered onto a large single cloth otherwise. Most of them are also numbered around the corner in embroidery, and the sample numbers also exceed 600 or 700, implying a rich iconographic variety that once existed. So many of the early examples have the backing cloth of the Indian cotton, and this is one of the diagnostic elements for the early date of the mid to late 1990s to the early 2000s, as Indian cotton is currently out of use for sample designs. And I would like to show you some sample designs. So these are so-called Kathmandu dragons. This is one of the most common themes. And it often comes with inscriptions, Kathmandu on top and Nepal at the bottom. And also this is targeting very general tourists as well. One professor in Nepali studies at SOAS, Professor Michael Hutt, he said he commissioned one Kathmandu dragon in Pokhara in the mid-1970s. Of course, they looked much different from now, but he's now looking for it for me as a material. But it's kind of existed in some form prior to the particular embroidery movement I'm talking about. And I also found a extremely rare three-headed Kathmandu dragon, as well as a winged dragon. I collected many numerous examples of dragons, but these are, I find, very rare, and they're all numbered and quite early. And so this is also a rare combination of Kathmandu dragon, Yin Yang, and Budais. Budais from the stupas like Swayampu or Bodhanath, they're kind of from medieval period onwards, they're kind of painted with eyes, like all seeing kind of Buddha eyes. And then the original Yin Yang, we don't know how, of course it's Chinese, but I don't know, we don't know how it kind of became so popular in Kathmandu. And trekking maps, so base camp motifs, also very popular among trekkers, and Also, many variations exist, like Kathmandu Lhasa. I think this route is now closed, so this is also very old. And but you can still commission around Annapurna. And this banner is a collection of small designs, shows a good variety of iconographies, including the Nepal logo, Buddha eyes, Om, mini Kathmandu dragon, free Tibet, Yak Yeti, double Vajra, or base camp logos. Many of the Indian, Nepalese, or Tibetan religious symbols were particularly favored by hippie-type tourists. The pair of the banners exhibit some symbols favored again, by such hippie-type tourists, including a personified sun, moon, Om, yin yang, cannabis leaves, and magic mushrooms, Celtic knots, Tibetan endless knot, and of course, traditionally, cannabis consumption among foreign tourists in Kathmandu was very, very popular. There used to be some official shops selling cannabis products, such as Eden Hashish Center on Freak Street in early 1970s. Freak Street still, which is still there today, was of course named after freaks, more commonly known as hippies. So against the backdrop of the ongoing hippie traveler culture in Kathmandu, the so-called Goa Trance movement during the late 1990s and 2000s were responsible for the emergence of a rich variety of the iconography of Subania embroidery in Kathmandu. The people involved in the Goa Trance movement attended beach parties in Goa and consumed some psychedelic drugs, and also traveled all over India. They also often traveled to Nepal to renew their visa for India, and they also commissioned some embroidery in Kathmandu in a communication with native embroidery craftsmen. So this chap here is called Goa Gil, and he also claims himself to be a Baba, and he's pretty famous. All the students here, Indian students here from Bombay, all know him as well. And so those hippie type travelers wore the embroidery while traveling or back home. One American traveler I met in Manali was wearing his leather outfit with souvenir embroidery patches of the so-called mandala type, which identifies him as a hippie-type traveler. These mandala-type patches were most favored by Goa Trance people, and the iconography identifies each other as belonging to that same culture. So this also functioned as a means of symbolic communication among such types of tourists. When I saw him in a temple, he was in a group smoking chillum with Babas in a chillum circle, which has to go pradakshina, never anti-clockwise. But chillum smoking in a South Asian style was really a symbolic act of such hippie-type tourists. And they were using a vintage Italian chillum that is also a status symbol of experienced chillum smokers in hippie culture in India, and this particular one is almost I had 30 years old, and but there still are some artists like Albama or Daniel, like very famous people, and types of foreign travelers you come across in Himachal Pradesh in India. Some of them Israelis, like Italians, they have some Italian children sometimes. And so this is this example shows a so-called chillum dragon in the Himalayas with his trekking boots on, smoking chillum himself with red eyes. And so you can see how chillum smoking was symbolic. So it's a sample number 7. So what I call a hippie cultural assemblage also include some ritual, symbolic, magical items apart from souvenir embroidery of a particular type. especially so-called Baba bags are considered as a prestige items by hippies. They're produced by Babas, taking 3 months for each Baba bag as a part of the aesthetic practice. Babas often charge around as much as 3,000 rupee if it's genuine. But it's very strong and very beautiful bag and very rare to find. You cannot find in, you know, any of the souvenir shops. You have to negotiate with the Baba and then the Baba bags often have several stashes to hide the hashish or opium. It also has an inner chiron pocket. And this particular one also has a Om symbol embroidered. The one I got from my Baba was also with Om symbol. Baba never gives you Baba bags empty. So he put 10 rupee inside. But you know, the lot of stash, and I couldn't find it, and then I thought I lost it, and it came again, and he told me it's a Baba magic. Yeah. And this is a famous Chilom smoking scene, you know, with foreigners from Hare Ram Hare Krishna.
Yes, from the movie.
Movie was shot in Kathmandu. So, and then, so mandala types are quite... Oh, does it come back?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, excellent. So, so mandala types, that hippie types tourists prefer. These two are kind of, I find, they're quite rare. There's one guy specializing in mandala, and he had hundreds of mandalas I have to go through, but these particular ones, thank you. early examples are quite unique as well. The one with the various religious symbols of different cultures, and the other one is Adi Buddha. So the last case study I present is the iconography of the Iti, which incorporates the indigenous Hindu iconography. You can see, shivanized. Yeah, with lingam and Himalayas and everything. Anyway, I think everybody knows Yeti, the mythical creatures believed to be living in Himalayas, and people find footsteps and stuff. Anyway, so this is the earliest example of the Yeti I could find. I think it's from around 1995. I found in a very old hoard of sample designs. He carries a Himalayas with his left hand, showing his back. His hand with two fingers, heart-shaped ear, dropping eyes, hair standing on the end, or tied waistband. Also his characteristic iconographic elements. So this iconography was inherited in later examples, as you can see, but the Yeti became more deformed as if he's a cartoon character. But these are very fine examples. Nowadays you cannot find embroiderers who can do this much detailed work. So this other but extremely fine example shows miniature Yeti in detail, even at 7 centimeter height, so that it's very, very small, and it's like calligraphy. It's like once you make a mistake, then you cannot correct it, but this guy does it very quickly. So this type of Yeti was originally a mascot character of a Royal Nepal airline. So the illustration shows the Yeti as a flight attendant. And I also find a Yeti bronze figure made in traditional Newari craftsmanship with the inscription Royal Nepal Airlines in front and Yeti on back. And this figure is believed to have been from the late 60s to the early 1970s. And however, the original Yeti is carrying drinks instead of Himalayas, which we see in, you know, among normal yetis. But in my view, the yeti was transformed into such due to an influence from the iconography of the Monkey God Hanuman carrying Dronagiri Mountain. The 19th century Udon Newari carving of Hanuman from Kathmandu, actually my private collection, shows him carrying the mountain in parallel to the representation of the yeti on Subani embroidery. Another life-size stone sculpture of Hanuman from Gorkha, possibly from the Shah dynasty, provides also strikingly similar iconography. It implies that the attribute of yeti, the Himalayas, was appropriated as an analogy to the iconography of Hanuman using a locally known form. So this also strengthened my view that so there are some really, really deep cultural interaction between the foreign travelers and the local craftsmen, and the local craftsmen and the indigenous cultures themselves. The last example of the yeti shows him trekking with a torch, yet retaining the basic iconographic elements of the yeti. It seems that the yeti also became very popular among trekking tourists. I mean, some hippies also do trekking, but particularly this is trekking yeti. So, the Subani embroidery of Kathmandu to conclude. Sorry. Anyway, sorry, I'll show this first. show the clear interaction between the locals and hippie-type foreign travelers in a process of a cultural appropriation. So there was communication between hippie-type foreign travelers and local embroiderers at one level, and at the same time there was an engagement of hippie-type foreign travelers in the indigenous religious practices, as we saw in the Chum smoking. And this guy also... went too far. This photo is from 1968, showing a real hippie fully engaged in Buddhist meditation I think it's from Swayampunath in Nepal, and so presenting a very strong case of cultural appropriation. And then the obvious junction between what is represented on embroidery and a person who is wearing it confirms the embedded meaning of its cultural significance across two different cultures. And the case of the iconographic development of the yeti also shows that cultural interaction between one's own and the others is not always one way, as the native ideas are also negotiated at multi-levels. And these two photos also show that the practice of Subani embroidery have also been adopted by the local religious practitioners. These photos were taken by me on a trek to the holy lake of Gosaikunda, the home to Lord Shiva, above 4,000 meters high. In this religious context, the pilgrim is where the Subani embroidery works of Om and Ganja leaf, respectively, which are both originally created for hippie foreign travelers. But obviously they're making pilgrimage to Shiva as a holy site, so it's quite relevant. And of course, the presence of such shared cultural practice also could signify the acceptance of their own native culture, interpreted by others, such as foreign hippie-type travelers. Yeah, thank you very much. That was it. But I'm not sure about the Rasta color, but they're both Nepalese.
Yeah,
it
seemed like the research for them was the research for that was lots of fun.
It was quite time consuming, and I had to talk to embroiderers all the time, and then I also have to pay some money. like all the samples. Like, even I offer like sometimes 3,000 rupee, they don't sell. Like that's a lot of money, but they don't sell. And because it's not easy to make, and it's the kind of, you know, tool for marketing, and and then but I spent maybe 2-3 years, so then finally I could get everything I wanted. Mm-hmm. And, but still I have to look for some. I have to do digging. I went through thousands.
Just a little comment. First of all, that was like the best paper ever.
Yeah.
I mean, anything I've enjoyed in a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, I mean, obviously no one here has ever been a hippie-type traveller, but would Sanskrit exist as a subject? Anyway. It's actually quite helpful for me thinking about things. I almost the only field work I do is when I go to Thailand and I deal with animist shrines. And what's interesting about the shrines there is that they're spontaneous. So I'm interested in spontaneity in putting together religious symbols. Mm-hmm. And unlike animist shrines in, say, Bali, where there's definite rules for how you create the symbolism, in Thailand, people just come up with what's there, what speaks to them in the moment, in the context, in that place. Sometimes it's broken, sometimes it's not. But there's a kind of a chance to see, in some cases, where things are happening quite spontaneously, just what symbolism is working and what syntheses are working. And that's really interesting, I think, just in the perspective of watching culture being happening, as you say, cultural appropriation happening, just watching culture happening religiously in the moment. And so that's really interesting. And that's just partly just a comment, that it sheds an interesting light on how that's happening in those contexts. And maybe just also that the hardest part for me in dealing with these kinds of spontaneous symbol creations is capturing what on earth reasoning is going on behind what creates these syntheses or mixes or whatever. Because it's quite hard to be quite hard to interview and say, so why that symbol there? Or why do people go for this one? What is it? What are the associations this is having? Why the Yeti? What is he doing for the hippie figures? What is he capturing and expressing? So I'd just be interested in how, if you've had answers to those, or how you might get answers to questions, or whether it's even relevant to get answers to questions about what these symbolisms are and why they're speaking at each of these given moments, and following the meme of what they're signifying.
But it's a very interesting point because all of them emerged definitely spontaneously, and then of course the embroiderers Muslim, but they don't mind, creating all sorts of different religious symbols of other religions. But of course, it couldn't have happened in India itself, in Nepal there's high degree of kind of religious tolerance. So there was that kind of environment where, creating their own corpus of iconographies that borrowed from different religions, kind of publicly accepted. But at the same time, all these symbols. Had a very specific meaning. That it's not just having Om here. Like, doesn't mean I'm interested in Indian mythology or mysticism or whatever. It was a language of all the hippies. Hari Om, they of course spent some time with Babas and then they find it kind of quite holy, and it it has some kind of you know, effect of amulet kind of thing. Because originally, in the original context, Japanese embroidery was for the backpack protection. So it's kind of ritualistic meaning as well. And then of course, certain symbols like Yeti and so on like, come in. And then but maybe they are kind of all connected through their kind of spiritual perspective. But it's sometimes, you know, but this is a context where it was created originally, and then of course anyone can go and ask for these embroideries and then lose its meaning and everything, and then it has to contextualize, and so it has that kind of a danger. But
already it's interesting what you said already. You're like, okay, some of these are meaning are about being part of the community of people who have access to the babas, and some of these are about being part of respecting symbols as creating sacredness, holiness, or protection. So they have an amulet function, and then some of them might be about signaling membership of communities of hikers. So there are different, you've mentioned or hinted at different kinds of significance that the different kinds of symbols might have, which is a really fascinating.
And I'm sure it's sort of changed massively over time as well, right? Like in terms of, I mean, anyone nowadays who goes to Nepal, I mean, I know when I was there I got some things made from, and it wasn't really symbolizing sort of anything specific for me other than just, you know, just I went there.
Which I think is often an important category of much of what's going on.
And also as the Goa trance scene sort of changed over time as well. It seems that the earlier generation was more into sort of Indian stuff, and the present sort of psychedelic scene is less involved, has less at stake in India. It seems almost, I don't know, and that's that kind of symbolism.
Yeah, some parties were kind of restricted, but still, you know, you find in Goa some embroidery shops, but they're from Nepal. And you can, you know, that rider, the American guy, he's actually the head of a rider team called Shiva Riders. They do kind of riding, lot of them. Ride from Pushkar to Goa, like every year. I don't know if they do. Okay. I don't know if they do do it, but he was once ahead, and then he's got the amazing embroidery of Shiva on the back of his bike, but he said he did it in Goa. But shame I didn't take a photograph, and I hope to see him again at some point. But yeah, it's changing, and then there was a Goa trance in Kathmandu as well. One guy from Switzerland was organizing it. Wasn't that big.
And it was in the '70s that there were just shops. There were hashish shops.
Hashish shops. It was like coffee shops, more like you can buy them there, and then you can smoke whatever you wanted. And then
that's why everyone was going.
there's quite a few others as well. But some of them had just license as a cafe. For example, near Freak Street there was a shop called a cafe called Don't Pass Me By. That means don't pass me by when they are smoking a marijuana cigarette. And so now it's in decline, and then they're losing all that traditional iconography. So I went the best time to collect traditional iconography, and so I wanna try to give them back to the embroiderers, so that they can maintain, you know, that especially Yeti and stuff, you know, can work as a cultural symbol. But the origin of Yeti I'm working on, and you know, there's, you know, Sandra from Sociology department. He wrote a book books on yogi and stuff.
Wandering Sadhus.
Yeah, Wandering Sadhus. Yeah, and she's also helping me to trace the origin of Yeti. But she said that she has a flight attendant's bag from Royal Nepal Airline in 1970s with a Yeti logo on it. But she said she's somewhere in her house, somewhere, and she's looking for it. And she can let me know as soon as she finds it.
And it's interesting that that all the embroiderers, you said, were Muslims.
Yeah, mostly. Some of them from Tarai region, some of them from Bihar, even, India. And very few Hindus. But also Hindus also do, and obviously no problem for Hindus to do it.
Yeah, but I mean, you said that in India it would have been more of a problem for this kind of thing, not because there's there would be more resistance to like making
depiction of idols and
really?
Human forms. One of them, one of the embroiderers in Kathmandu. I think the best embroiderer I ever saw. His name is Kushbu. He's a Muslim. Sounds a bit like Hindu name, but he actually went to Saudi Arabia to do this business, but it wasn't accepted because all the faces and everything, and so it's difficult as far as Islam is concerned.
In terms of indigenous designs, are there any, being Nepal being located within, again, surrounded by India and China, are there any borrowings in terms of designs that particularly when you said the Hindus were designing? And also, in the picture that you saw, like you saw this Yeti with the carrying the mountain, and then what the Royal Airlines is carrying something. And so in terms of, maybe even in terms of what the symbol means, are there any rules? At what point do they change, the mountain to carrying trees? Are there any
It's hard to say. But first of all, a lot of, oh my God, did I do it? Oh, anyway. For example, I think this one is for example here you find a lot of symbols borrowed from all over the world almost. But especially surrounding countries. I mean, they're more popular. They're quite common as well in Nepal itself, but more prevalent in India, but you also find the Tibetan Om as well, and a lot of influences from Tibet as well. Not so much of this one, but for example, this one, it's called the Free Tibet, and the Dharma Chakra, and Double Vajra and everything. So they're quite Tibetan, and then Buddha is also have a Tibetan Om Mani Padme Hum and stuff. And then, but originally, some of the embroiderers said originally this business was started by Tibetan Muslims and the Tibetan businessmen. And also, you find the yin yang and stuff. That's from China, but we don't know when it came into Nepal, and then it's very popular now there. And of course, these are so-called Celtic knots, like tattoo-like tribal kind of design. They are Celtic originally, and and the ganja leaf is Rasta. That's from Jamaica, kind of thing. But it's hard to say when the Yeti came to called this Himalayas, because iconography is just I mean, especially like attributes and stuff, just you know, like just travel kind of through, and then like one attribute of one deity can be held by another, like I mean, in art, but it's interesting, like the process, you know, how it can be replaced rather randomly or with some kind of religious kind of meaning, you know. It's really hard to tell, but at some point, but in this case, you know, you can see the kind of influence.
It's interesting when you see the whole pennant of lots of different symbols, that you get a sense of how the makers have an eye for what can be emblematic, and that the public want emblems. Yeah. There's something about creating condensed symbols. Yeah. And I always notice this whenever you go to a country with a tourist industry. Mm. Like in Peru, the Catholics are getting, you know, they need to make an Inca symbol. And they very quickly find, but also what they're doing, of course, is catching on to what ideas are fascinating to the tourists. Or like, there'll be dream catchers everywhere. Mm. No Peruvian uses dream catchers.
Yeah.
But something about their understanding of the spiritual goals of the tourists and their mediating that was just interesting. Mm. And their notion, their strong sense of something like the semiotics of a tourist needing to have something concrete to take home. Mm. And what makes a good symbol.
So it's kind of mutually constructive in the sense of this identity. That was really fascinating. Okay, no, really.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I think we should probably wrap up here. Right. Just to let everyone know, next week is our final seminar, and we're going to be having Vade, who's over there, as well as Yonit, talking. So please do come along for the final one. Thank you.